Hello, this is Ed Reedy from the Talking Information Center with the Friday, May 7th reading of Newsweek magazine. The top story from the world, Antony Blinken warns reckless and aggressive Russia over Ukraine, by Brendan Cole. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has reiterated Washington, D.C.'s backing for Kiev in the face of Russian aggression in the first visit to Ukraine by a senior official from President Joe Biden's administration. In the one-day visit on Thursday, Blinken spoke with Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba and President Volodymyr Zelensky. The trip sends a warning to Moscow and a message of support to Ukraine amid alarm at the biggest buildup of Russian troops by its border since Moscow seized Crimea in 2014. The visit also comes as the White House looks to move on from the controversy of the previous administration's relationship with Ukraine, during which ex-President Donald Trump was accused of withholding aid to press Zelensky to dig up dirt on Biden. In a press conference with Zelensky, Blinken said that discussions between the pair had focused on the threat Russia continues to pose to Ukraine. "We have been watching this very, very closely and very, very carefully." Russia announced last month that it would withdraw troops from its border with Ukraine. Blinken said on Thursday that significant forces remain there and that the U.S. was monitoring the situation very, very closely. Regardless of Russia's withdrawal, Blinken added, one thing that is tragically constant, that is there are casualties every day along the line of contact in eastern Ukraine. The continued Russian military presence by the border is in the tens of thousands, according to some estimates, as Moscow continues to closely eye the U.S.-led military exercises in Europe and Africa called Defender Europe 2021. With Zelensky sitting opposite him, Blinken said in a press conference, "I can tell you, Mr. President, we stand strongly with you. Partners do as well. We look to Russia to cease reckless and aggressive actions." Ahead of the visit, the State Department said in a statement that since 2014, the United States has provided Ukraine more than $4.6 billion in total assistance. Earlier, Blinken had told a BBC radio interview that the U.S. was less focused on President Putin or any one individual and more focused on Russia's actions. Citing the SolarWinds hack, election interference, and the poisoning and jailing of the opposition politician Alexei Navalny, Blinken told the Today program, "If Russia acts recklessly or aggressively, then we will respond." Relations between Washington, D.C. and Moscow may be at a historic low, but much is hoped to be achieved in a proposed summit between Biden and his Russian counterpart, which is being slated for June. Newsweek has contacted the U.S. State Department, the Ukrainian Foreign Ministry, and the Russian Foreign Ministry for comment. From the U.S., Caitlyn Jenner trails John Cox in recall election against Newsom, by Alexandra Hutzler. California's John Cox is leading the Republican field as the state gears up for a likely recall election later this year, according to a new poll. Survey USA News found that Cox had a 9% support among registered voters when they are asked who should replace Democrat Gavin Newsom and serve out the rest of the term if he is recalled. Cox had the highest level of support of the 9 conservative candidates the company polled as possible contenders. Trailing Cox were Caitlyn Jenner and Richard Grenell, both of whom garnered 5% support among respondents. Grenell, however, has not officially thrown his hat into the ring for governor, as Cox and Jenner have. Most of the California voters polled, 38%, said they wouldn't support any of the Republicans listed. Another 26% said they were undecided on whom they would support if a recall race takes place. Cox hit the campaign trail earlier this week for his Meet the Beast bus tour alongside a 1,000-pound live Kodiak bear named Tag. The 65-year-old businessman and perennial political candidate has said the Golden State needs big beastly changes. On Tuesday, Cox launched a $5 million statewide TV advertisement that once again featured a live bear, as well as a talking parrot that repeatedly mocked Newsom as a pretty boy. Cox last ran for governor in 2018, a race he lost to Newsom by more than 20 points. Will you choose Beauty or the Beast, who will hit the ground running, thundering, slashing our outrageous cost of living and housing? A political outsider who will shake up Sacramento and slash taxes? A narrator said in the nearly three-minute video. Jenner, an Olympic decathlete turned reality TV star, also released her first campaign advertisement this week. The clip attacked Newsom over the state's coronavirus lockdowns and his insider-friendly politics. I came here with a dream 48 years ago to be the greatest athlete in the world, Jenner said in the video. Now I enter a different kind of race, arguably my most important one yet, to save California. In April, the California Secretary of State's office certified a 1.62 million valid signatures, roughly 125,000 more names than required to set up a vote on whether Newsom should be ousted from office. Officials are still carrying out procedural steps that must be completed before the lieutenant governor can officially call the special election. A plurality of California voters, 47%, said Newsom should remain in office. 36% Newsom should be recalled, according to Survey USA. Survey USA interviewed 750 California adults between April 30 and May 2nd. Of those, 642 were identified as registered voters and were asked a subset of questions concerning the potential recall election. From the U.S., 1,050 people died in police encounters between George Floyd's murder and Derek Chauvin verdict, by David Brennan. At least 1,050 civilians and law enforcement personnel died in police encounters between George Floyd's murder and the conviction of Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis Police Department officer who killed him. Floyd, 46, died in police custody on May 25, 2020. Chauvin, 45, had held his knee on Floyd's neck for more than 9 minutes, even as his victim pleaded with the officer because he could not breathe. Floyd lost consciousness and subsequently died. This murder of a black man by white police officers was captured on video. The footage horrified Americans and the wider world, reinvigorating the movement to end systemic racism in the United States, sparking off a year of nationwide protests. Chauvin was found guilty of second-degree murder, third-degree murder, and manslaughter on April 20, 2021. A few weeks shy of the first anniversary of Floyd's death. He will be sentenced in June and could face decades behind bars. Floyd's murder and the subsequent trial have been at the heart of the resurgence of the Black Lives Matter movement in the United States, which stimulated allied racial justice movements around the world. His death has become a symbol of police brutality, particularly against minorities. Floyd's family, campaign groups, and lawmakers all celebrated Chauvin's conviction, but he is only one small part of America's violent epidemic. Then, as jurors were deliberating in the Chauvin trial, a police officer shot and killed 16-year-old Makai Bryant in Columbus, Ohio. She was armed with a knife during an altercation with other teenagers at her home and was attacking someone at the time. What the data shows: between Floyd's death and Chauvin's conviction, at least 979 people were killed in encounters with law enforcement personnel, according to the data collected by the Mapping Police Violence website. Chauvin's conviction is a statistical anomaly. In the 1,127 police killings recorded in 2020, only 16 cases, 1.4%, resulted in a charge against the offending officer. The violence is borne disproportionately by the black community, members of which are three times more likely to be killed by police than their white counterparts. This racial disparity is amplified in America's biggest cities. In Chicago, for example, police kill 22 times more black people than white people. 28% of people killed by police in 2020 were black, despite black people making up 13% of the population. Between Floyd's death and Chauvin's conviction, 181 black people died in police encounters. At least 71 law enforcement personnel have been killed in the line of duty this year, according to the Officer Down Memorial page, nonprofit, underlying the deadly risk police also face in these encounters. This total does not include those who died from natural causes, from COVID-19, from 9/11 related illnesses, or in accidents not involving others. Though they are a small portion of all deaths, police are trained aggressively about the threats to their health and lives in these encounters, and a sense of constant vulnerability instilled in new recruits. Rosa Brooks, a Georgetown University tenured law professor, wrote a book about her experience signing up as a reserve police officer with the Washington, D.C. Metropolitan Police Department. The chief lesson learned at the academy was this: anyone can kill you at any time, Brooks wrote in Tangled Up in Blue, an excerpt of which Newsweek has published. The dead cops were all heroes, but it was quietly intimated they were also failures. Mostly, we were told, they died because they weren't prepared. Newsweek has collated a chronological list of all deaths in police encounters that occurred between Floyd's death and the Chauvin verdict. What Cops Really Learn at Police Academy, Anyone Can Kill You at Any Time, by Rosa Brooks. When Rosa Brooks, a Georgetown University tenured law professor, decided to become a reserve police officer with the Washington, D.C. Metropolitan Police Department in 2015, she explored the blue wall of silence from the inside. Through her experience, she discovered that today's hot-button issues about policing are far from black and white. In her recent book, Tangled Up in Blue, Brooks shares what she learned on the force, her recommendations for better laws and policing, and her analysis of the complex issues surrounding race and policing that are increasingly timely in a world racked by the use of deadly force by police and the resulting public protests. In this excerpt from her book, Brooks explores the indoctrination cops get as part of their training about their own vulnerability, both at the hands of the people they've sworn to protect and their own department, and how that affects their actions on the job. Anyone can kill you at any time. The chief lesson learned at the academy was this: anyone can kill you at any time. This topic wasn't listed on the formal lesson plan, but was implicit in the stories the instructors told and the videos the recruits obsessively watched, both in class and during break time. Week after week, we watched footage of cops getting attacked, injured, or killed. The world, it seemed, was a dangerous place for police officers. They were perpetually being stabbed, shot, punched, kicked, run over, drowned, poisoned by fentanyl, and bitten by savage dogs. The instructors referred to these as officer safety videos. When we had breaks or got ahead of the curriculum, had nothing else to do, which happened a lot, we huddled around iPads and laptops and watched more videos, like kids bonding over their favorite YouTube clips. Recruits sat around in the lunchroom and swapped suggestions of cops in trouble videos to watch. There were, we learned, 1,000 ways for cops to be hurt or killed. On our screens, unwitting police officers conducted traffic stops, only to be gunned down by meth heads previously invisible behind invisible tinted rear windows. Officers rushed heedlessly toward disabled trucks and inhaled fatal levels of anhydrous ammonia. They stopped to assist stranded motors and were struck by passing cars. They responded to domestic violence calls and were hit over the head by poker-wielding husbands. They were pushed off bridges by fleeing felons and drowned in raging river currents. They were overpowered by combative suspects who grabbed their service weapons and shot them in the head. They were beaten to death by crazed PCP addicts who kept right on pummeling them despite being repeatedly tasered. They were poisoned, strangled, and pushed off the roofs of tall buildings. The dead cops were all heroes, but it was quietly intimated they also were failures. Mostly, we were told, they died because they weren't prepared. They let down their guard. They neglected to take the appropriate tactical precautions. They decided their ballistic vest was hot and uncomfortable, so they left it at home when they went on patrol, and suffered the consequences when they were shot 6 times in the chest. They sat in their cars, too busy scrolling through personal text messages on their phones, to notice the deranged drug addict lurching toward them, until it was too late and he shot them in the head. They interviewed domestic violence suspects in their kitchens, forgetting that kitchens are full of weapons, until the suspect grabbed a butcher knife from a drawer and stabbed them in the heart. They told the meek-looking elderly driver to go ahead and retrieve his registration and insurance, figuring he was harmless, until he shot them in the neck with the gun he pulled from the glove compartment. There is no such thing as a routine call, the instructors told us. Even the most seemingly benign situation could turn lethal in an instant. You had to approach every situation tactically, which meant you had to always be thinking about the numerous ways in which you could be killed, and act in a manner calibrated to keep you from becoming a dead hero. A good day is a day you go home safe, the instructors told us. Accordingly, Saturdays at the academy were devoted to physical training and defensive tactics. Our PT instructor was Sergeant Flanagan, a short, well-muscled Irishman in his 50s. I liked Flanagan, despite the fact that he immediately announced that we should come in each Saturday wearing white T-shirts with our surnames written in black marker on the back, rendering obsolete all the gray T-shirts we had previously been told to acquire. As spring turned to summer, Reserve Recruit Class 2016-01 progressed from learning how to walk — you're never ever going to turn your back on a suspect, you need to move away from a suspect, you're going to take a step sideways and back, never straight back, or you'll lose your balance and fall on your ass — to learning to fight and use control holds and pain compliance measures. We practice on punching bags, rubber dummies, and one another, learning kicks, palm strikes, and elbow strikes. We learned how to break someone's finger grip and how to twist an arm back painfully to force a bad guy into compliance. Chokeholds were forbidden by Washington, D.C. Metropolitan Police Department, MPD. Too many people placed in chokeholds ended up dead, like Eric Garner in New York City. So no chokeholds. Prohibited. Verboten, said Flanagan. Wentz, the former New York Police Department copy, broke in. That's idiotic. Properly used chokeholds are perfectly safe. It's just a training issue. People don't just understand how to use them. Eric Garner didn't die because he was put in a chokehold. He died because of positional asphyxia. Flanagan was unmoved. Technically, yes, but what everybody and their cousin saw on TV was Eric Garner being choked. We'll talk about positional asphyxia in a minute, but for now, just remember, no chokeholds. The policy is what the policy is. Better to be judged by 12 than carried by 6, countered Wentz. Flanagan was getting impatient. Look, Wentz, you find yourself in an actual life-or-death situation, and you have to grab someone around the neck to keep him from killing you. I'm not going to tell you not to do that. If it's life or death, you do what you have to do, but the department's policy is no chokeholds. So here in MPD, we don't use chokeholds, just because someone's pain is a pain in the ass and resists cuffing. No chokeholds, okay? We moved on to discuss positional asphyxia, restraining a subject by putting your knee or foot on his back while he lay face down was also prohibited by department policy, because being prone for an extended period, particularly with weight on the back, could kill someone, especially if the subject happened to have a weak heart or other medical issues. You're struggling with a suspect. It's a fight. You end up on top of him, and his face is in the dirt. It happens. But you don't stay in that position, Flanagan went on. You get the guy under control, and you get off him, fast, because the longer he's face down, the more risk there is. 4 years later, George Floyd's death became an infamous and tragic case in point. Wentz looked like he was about to argue. It's the same as chokehold, said Flanagan. Policy says no. You need to understand that. But if it's life or death, if you're all alone and you can't get the cuffs onto his wrists, and the guy weighs 300 pounds, and the second you shift your weight off his back, he's going to throttle you, well, you have a right to go home at the end of the day. Wentz nodded, satisfied by this concession. Just be aware, Flanagan added, you're still going to have to explain why you violated department policy. The tension was articulated over and over in the academy and later out on the streets. Cops had two messages drilled into them. On the one hand, you were in constant danger. Any situation, no matter how seemingly low risk, could turn deadly in an instant, and you had to always be ready to do whatever it took to protect yourself. On the other hand, you had to abide by MPD policies, because if you deviated from them in a way that made the department look bad, you would be hung out to dry. The department would not give you the benefit of the doubt. You'd be suspended, fired, or prosecuted in a millisecond. Even for us reserve recruits, this created a constant gnawing feeling of vulnerability. Soon we'd be sent out to the streets, where, according to our instructors, we would find ourselves trapped between a hostile public full of people eager to hurt or kill us and a hostile department bureaucracy eager to throw us to the wolves if required by PR considerations. From Tech and Science, NASA astronaut says floating in space is like being a superhero. It is that cool. By Ed Brown. Imagine having a job so good that you never wanted to come home from work. For Mike Finke, this is a reality. Finke, 54, is a NASA astronaut who has spent over a year in space, at one time holding the national record. Since reaching space for the first time in 2004, Finke has traveled aboard Russian Soyuz capsules and NASA's Space Shuttle Endeavour orbiter. He's also due to fly on the first crewed flight of Boeing's CST-100 Starliner capsule at the end of this year or the start of 2022. Today is National Astronaut Day in the United States, a date created by the UNIFI Space Agency to promote the work that astronauts do. To mark the occasion, Finke told Newsweek about the highs and lows of spending months at a time aboard the International Space Station, ISS, his experiences with the space shuttle program, the existential fear of spacewalk gone wrong, and how, in the future, becoming an astronaut could be the reality for many more of us. Some quotes have been edited for clarity. Astronauts have talked about experiencing a change in their perspective when they view Earth from space. Have you experienced this? Answer: one day I flew over the entire Amazon River, and it took 8 minutes. I got to see it from the beginning all the way to the ocean. We have an incredibly beautiful planet. We can see so many things from the ISS, but what we don't see are the borders, the boundaries. My kids, sometimes, when they were younger, they'd sit and fight in the back of the minivan. And of course you want to, as a dad, turn around and say, "Hey, stop fighting. You're brothers and sisters. You should love each other. You shouldn't be fighting. And don't make me come back there, right?" I have almost the exact same feeling when I'm looking at planet Earth and looking at the whole universe. It's like, "Hey, kids, stop fighting down there." So yes, I had a perspective change, and I can maybe characterize it as a motivation to stop being destructive as humans, but to be constructive and to go on these great space adventures that are just out there. Question: you've flown in both Soyuz capsule and also the Space Shuttle Endeavour. What was it like to go between the two? Answer: I was one of the first Americans to fly on the Soyuz, and it was amazing, because when I was younger, it was the Cold War and the Soviet Union. At that time, they were kind of an enemy. And so in 2004, we found ourselves on a beautiful April day launching off of Yuri Gagarin launch pad, and it was absolutely incredible and amazing. For me, it was a very strange move from a very closed environment of the Soyuz, which I flew twice and then flew on the American Space Shuttle. It was from a cramped utilitarian spacecraft that had one mission, and it does this mission well, of taking people to the space station and safely back home and serving as a lifeboat. The Space Shuttle was a multi-purpose use vehicle, like a big pickup truck that we'd like to drive in the U.S., and so it was amazing to go from small utilitarian things to something that's very general and multi-purpose with plenty of room. Question: with that in mind, what do you think about the more modern spacecraft like SpaceX's Dragon capsule, NASA's Orion, or the Boeing Starliner? Answer: we did so many wonderful things with the space shuttle, but now everything is directed to a single purpose, and you can see that SpaceX's Dragon, for example, or Boeing Starliner, they're both for one mission, pretty much, which is to get into low Earth orbit, maybe go to the space station or a space station. But they won't do much more in their current design, so you can make them look very good. I think Elon Musk from SpaceX has a certain aesthetic, and Boeing put their corporate flavor into the Starliner, you can see that they're not quite as utilitarian as 1960s-era spacecraft like Soyuz or Apollo. We're trying to make them cooler with much more integrated cockpits, better sensors, and we can put more people on them. Question, what's your favorite thing about being in space? Answer, I'm hoping my next mission is a long mission, and what I like about being up there is being up there. No 2 days are the same. One day you're working on cutting-edge science with recombinant DNA and genomics. The next day you're fixing the toilet. One day you're moving around a multi-billion-dollar experiment, such as the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer, with the robot arms. And the third day you're going to be talking to some school kids in an underrepresented part of Africa, for example, that I would never have a chance to do otherwise. I enjoy being weightless. I like looking at the stars. I like looking at the Earth go by. And it's fun. Fun as heck. Every Marvel superhero movie or any of the other superhero movies where you're watching people fly and you said that could be so cool, I will assure you that it is that cool. It is that much fun. And you're super strong. You can pick up very heavy things. 1,000 pounds, no problem. What's your least favorite thing about being in space? Answer, I'm very blessed. I really like my family. I very much like my wife and my children. And when I'm away from them, and I'm not helping them as a father and a husband, then I feel a bit bad. In 2004, because of the space shuttle disaster, we moved crews around, and I ended up flying sooner than I thought we would. And my wife was expecting our second child. So I had a daughter born while I was in space on my first mission. That's a little bit tough for a dad to miss a child coming into the world. And so those kinds of things, when you're not home, you're not there to help with the math homework, that part is tough. But if I could bring my family members with me to space, I don't think I'd ever come home. Question, during your time in space, you've logged a total of 9 spacewalks in which you have exited your spacecraft while in orbit. Was there ever a time you felt scared? Answer, very few astronauts get a chance to do spacewalks. I've been lucky. But I will say this, even the most courageous, steely-eyed astronaut, with your first few steps and handrail movements, and you're on the outside of the space station, there is that existential feeling, right? You look down and you see it's a 250-mile drop. Your hands just don't want to move because you're afraid you'll fall. I mean, I don't have a fear of heights at all, but my first couple of spacewalks, I look down and say, wow, that could be very scary, but I know what I'm doing. This is not a problem. I convinced myself, and then I had to actually look at my hands and tell them to start moving and do the job. On my first spacewalk, it was in a Russian spacesuit. I got outside and I looked down at my control panel, and we have an analog oxygen gauge, which tells me how much oxygen I have in the tank for my suit. It was supposed to go from full to about half throughout the 6-hour spacewalk, but it was actually moving, and it's like, well, this is not right. We have an electronic system that tells us if things are wrong with your spacesuit and gives you warning lights and everything. I had no warning lights, but I knew something was wrong. And just at the point where I started to say this, our ground controllers in Russian, they said, hey, what's going on with your spacesuit? I said, the oxygen gauge is moving. I don't know what's going on. There's no caution warning lights. I'm not comfortable with this. I think I might need to go inside. And they said, yeah, we don't know what's going on either. You better come inside. And so I went back inside and brought in all my tethers and closed the hatch. Turns out there was a manual valve that was showing that it was closed, but it still had a little bit of open to it. And it was leaking the extra oxygen into my suit, which it didn't need to do. Had we stayed outside, it would have become a problem. Fortunately, we had that analog gauge that told us something the electronics did not. The following week, we went back outside and accomplished our mission. When I talk to my new astronaut friends and people who are just doing it for the first time, it's like, listen to your suit, look at your suit, pay attention to things, because you just can't count on the electronics always. Question, lately, what do you think lies ahead for future astronauts? Will it become a more popular career, an easier experience to have? Answer, what is it to be an astronaut? Are there different flavors or different types of astronauts? For me, I consider myself a professional astronaut who works for the government. So this is my profession. I've flown with people, Charles Simonoya, Richard Garriott, and they were space adventurers, and I think they can claim the title of astronaut. But they're not professional government astronauts. They did this for fun. So what is an astronaut? That's a good question. Names aside and titles aside, if you're a person interested in going to space to fly around the Earth, the chances are much higher now. Part of it is because we're bringing down the cost. But we have companies out there, Blue Origin, for example, Virgin Galactic, that are really starting to expand, where you can touch the edge of space, and for a few minutes, you can be weightless. If we look even further to the future, we will have people that are just specialized in one thing, like a manufacturing specialist. So you won't necessarily need aerospace degrees or the military experience, but you'll need some kind of specialty to do the job. I'm hoping 15 to 20 years from now, we have 50,000 people in space. We have a continued presence in low Earth orbit of non-government entities. We have private companies. We have hotels. We have manufacturing. This is all within our near future, and it's so exciting to be a part of it. From the U.S., the first day of Donald Trump's new website recalls his earlier Twitter storms, by Daniel Villarreal. Republican former President Donald Trump spent the first full day of his new blog slamming his Republican congressional critics and large social media companies. His attacks bore similarities to his previous Twitter storms during his presidency. Trump launched his new blog, named From the Desk of Donald J. Trump, on Tuesday evening. Since its launch, two of his posts have directly attacked Wyoming Republican Representative Liz Cheney, and one has attacked Republican Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. Cheney has repeatedly called out Trump for his repeated and baseless claims that he lost the 2020 presidential election due to widespread voter fraud. McConnell blamed Trump for inciting the January 6th Capitol insurrection. Trump has recently called McConnell a dumb son of a bitch and a stone-cold loser. Warmonger Liz Cheney, who has virtually no support left in the great state of Wyoming, continues to unknowingly and foolishly say that there was no election fraud in the 2020 presidential election, Trump wrote in a Wednesday morning blog post. In fact, the evidence, including no legislative approvals, as demanded by the U.S. Constitution, shows the exact opposite. In the same post, Trump slammed McConnell as gutless and clueless. Trump added, he blew two seats in Georgia that should never have been lost, a reference to the two Senate seats won by Democrats in January's special election. Trump's post referred to a common claim made by Republicans after Trump lost the 2020 election by over 7 million popular votes and 74 electoral votes. The claim states that various local and state election officials violated Article 2 of the U.S. Constitution when they changed their voting policies due to COVID-19 without prior approval by state legislatures. Republican Texas Senator John Cornyn said he was not convinced by the claim's legal reasoning. In a second post, also published on Wednesday, Trump wrote, Liz Cheney is a warmongering fool who has no business in Republican Party leadership. The post went on to endorse Republican New York Representative Elise Stefanik to take over Cheney's role as GOP conference chair. In another Wednesday blog post, Trump blasted Facebook and Twitter for banning him from their platforms. Free speech has been taken away from the President of the United States because the radical left lunatics are afraid of the truth. But the truth will come out anyway, bigger and stronger than ever before, Trump wrote. The people of our country will not stand for it. These corrupt social media companies must pay a political price and must never again be allowed to destroy and decimate our electoral process. On Wednesday, Facebook's oversight board upheld the social network's decision to ban Trump after Trump supporters tried to mount an insurrection to overturn the election results at the Capitol on January 6. Twitter permanently banned him for similar reasons on January 8. for a brief while, Trump's blog posts were being shared on Twitter by @DJTDesk, the official account from the desk of Donald J. Trump. In response, Twitter users began tweeting messages with the hashtag #RemoveTrumpJack, urging Twitter's CEO to ban the account. The user said that the account effectively allowed Trump to get around his suspension from the platform. The account has since been suspended, as have other accounts mirroring Trump's blog posts. Trump's prolific Twitter use, or Twitter storms as they were called, defined his presidency. He often used the social media platform to float possible policies, repeat his favored talking points, and insult his political enemies. By December 17, 2017, less than 1 year into his presidency, Trump spent a combined 40 hours of his time tweeting. The Globe found that he posted many of his more incendiary tweets between 5 a.m. and 8 a.m., before staff workers typically arrived in the White House's West Wing. When Trump was hospitalized with COVID-19 in October 2020, he posted over 40 times to Twitter within 2 hours. Shortly after Democratic New York Governor Andrew Cuomo delivered his Democratic National Convention speech on August 18, 2020, Trump retweeted 11 posts criticizing Cuomo. On one day in June 2020, Trump posted 200 tweets and retweets, a personal record. His previous record had been 142 tweets posted during the January 2020 impeachment proceedings. Also in June 2020, Trump once sent 74 tweets within a single hour, a personal best. On May 1, Trump claimed that boring Twitter was losing users since his being banned. The platform has gained over 7 million new daily users since Trump was banned. GOP Senator Joni Ernst says Liz Cheney is allowed to express opinion, should stand her ground, by John Jackson. Senator Joni Ernst defended Representative Liz Cheney Wednesday from fellow Republicans who are attempting to oust her as House Republican Conference Chair. Instead of silencing the Wyoming Congresswoman, Ernst said GOP leaders should focus on party unity. Ernst, who has held her Iowa seat, Senate seat since 2015, spoke to Politico about Cheney in an interview published Wednesday. She told the outlet that Cheney has the right to speak freely and offered this advice to Republicans. At the end of the day, we need to all pull together as Republicans and make sure that we're securing seats. Any elected official should stand their ground. If you feel firmly about something, you should stand your ground, Ernst told Politico. I know Liz. I appreciate Liz so much, and she feels very strongly about her stance. And again, I know many Republicans that feel very strongly about their stance, pro-Trump, not for Trump, whatever it is. But at the end of the day, we have work to get done. During the interview, Ernst also emphasized her own personal loyalty toward former President Donald Trump. Cheney, meanwhile, has received a ton of backlash from fellow GOP members for repeatedly making public rejections of Trump's claims that the 2020 presidential election was rigged. On Monday, Cheney reiterated this stance, calling election fraud claims a big lie. Cheney also notably voted to impeach Trump on a charge of incitement of insurrection following the U.S. Capitol riots on January 6. Regarding the claims about Trump's role in inciting the riot, Cheney said in January, "There has never been a greater betrayal by a president of the United States of his office and his oath to the Constitution." Ernst, meanwhile, voted to acquit Trump in the impeachment trial. She also voted to certify the 2020 election for President Joe Biden, while other Republicans fought against the election results. However, while speaking with Politico, she reiterated her support of Trump. "I appreciate President Trump, and I appreciate all he's done for our country, and I think we made significant strides forward under the Trump administration, especially in our economy," Ernst said. "But everybody has the right to express their opinion." The words of support from Ernst came at a crucial time for Cheney. On Wednesday, Trump endorsed replacing her with New York Representative Elise Stefanik, as has the second-ranking House Republican, Representative Steve Scalise. Meanwhile, Ernst, the vice chair of the Senate Republican Conference, is the only other woman in elected GOP leadership. On Tuesday, Senator Mitt Romney also defended Cheney from recent criticism she's faced, tweeting, "Every person of conscience draws a line beyond which they will not go. Liz Cheney refuses to lie." From the world, top Iranian general says Israel could be defeated with a single operation, by Tom O'Connor. The head of Iran's elite Revolutionary Guard said recent events across the Middle East have exposed vulnerabilities in Israel, which he argued could be defeated with just one decisive blow should a conflict break out between the two top foes. In an interview aired Wednesday by the semi-official Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting, Major General Hossein Salami discussed recent developments he argued belied Israel's weakness. These included an apparent ongoing series of cyber attacks affecting dozens of Israeli companies that began late last year. The alleged execution of suspected Israeli spies in the northern Iraq city of Erbil in January, explosions that rattled a Petro-Israel port city of Haifa in February, last month's missile factory blast at a missile site, and landing of a Syrian anti-air missile near the Dimona nuclear reactor, as well as recent fire that broke out by Ben-Gurion International Airport. Salame said that all the vulnerabilities of the Zionist regime were demonstrated over the past few months, and that after 10 incidents, an 11th could follow. The senior military official said Israel was especially at risk due to its reliance on maritime trade, something he claimed accounted for 90% of Israel's trade. These routes, he said, could be easily disrupted, and he argued the country's relatively small size made it susceptible to a devastating strike. Their biggest weakness is that any tactical action could bring about a strategic defeat to them, Salamai said, meaning that just a single operation can ruin this regime. The remarks came as indirect talks between the U.S. and Iran continued to play out in Vienna with the aim of coordinating Washington's return to a multilateral nuclear deal abandoned in 2018 by former President Donald Trump. The two sides are attempting to overcome an impasse over the terms of a potential re-entry by President Joe Biden's administration and Tehran's re-implementation of uranium enrichment limits it suspended as a result of non-compliance by Western parties to the accord. As negotiations play out involving China, the European Union, France, Germany, Russia, and the United Kingdom, political tensions have arisen within Iran ahead of a presidential election set for June. The vote will bring about the end of Iranian President Hassan Rouhani's second and final term, and the Guardian Council is expected to soon announce a list of candidates that will vie to succeed him. Many are expected to represent more conservative elements, and even former military officials skeptical of Iran's strained diplomacy with the United States and Europe. Meanwhile, a shadowy conflict between Iran and Israel has continued to play out across the Middle East. Both sides have often blamed one another for unclaimed incidents, such as attacks that appear to have struck ships owned by both countries in the Red Sea in recent months. Iran has also accused Israel of clandestine efforts to disrupt the Islamic Republic's nuclear program, such as the assassination of a leading nuclear scientist in November and a blackout that struck a key facility in Natanz last month. Iranian officials have argued their nuclear program was never intended to produce a weapon of mass destruction. But Israeli officials doubt this and oppose a U.S. return to the nuclear agreement. At home, Israel was also undergoing political tensions, and the country struggled to form a government after the fourth election in just 2 years was held in March. Following Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's failure to form a governing coalition on Wednesday, President Reuven Rivlin tapped the Israeli leader's rival, Yair Lapid to attempt to pull together a new government, a development that would end the tenure of the longest-serving prime minister in Israeli history. The contest unfolds as clashes continue between Israeli security forces and Palestinians in Jerusalem. The strife erupted in recent days amid Israeli efforts to oust Palestinian residents in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of the disputed city's occupied east and replace them with Israelis claiming to have lived there prior to the establishment of Israel and the subsequent war with Arab states that broke out in 1948. The case has received international attention, including from Iran, which backs Palestine, claims to victory, settled prior to Israel's establishment. Tehran also has ties to militias operating in the Palestinian-controlled Gaza Strip, from which a wave of rocket attacks was launched last month. From the world, India's oxygen demand 7 times higher than in April, as new COVID cases top 412,000, by Julia Marnin. Oxygen demand in India is 7 times higher than in April, as the country still struggles to combat COVID-19 cases, with a total of 412,262 new infections on Thursday, the Associated Press reported. India is desperately trying to establish large oxygen plants and transport oxygen, as most hospitals in the country do not have independent oxygen plants, causing them to rely on liquid oxygen that needs to be transported in cylinders carried by tankers. On Wednesday, pressure in an oxygen line dropped at the Chengalpet Government Medical College Hospital in Tamil Nadu that resulted in the death of 11 COVID-19 patients. The Times of India reported authorities at the hospital said last week that they had repaired the oxygen pipelines, but oxygen consumption has doubled since they worked on it. About 3,980 new deaths were reported by the health ministry, adding to the total of 230,168 that experts believe is actually higher, according to the Associated Press. Some global media reports have raised concerns regarding distribution of global aid being sent to India in its fight against #COVID-19. India's health ministry said in a statement on Thursday, however, the aid is being effectively and promptly allocated and dispatched to states and UTs by the government of India. Infections in India hit another grim daily record on Thursday. The government denied reports that it was slow in distributing life-saving supplies from abroad. The number of new confirmed cases breached 400,000 for the second time since the devastating surge began last month. The 412,262 new cases pushed India's official tally to more than 21 million. India created a sea bridge on Tuesday to ferry oxygen tankers from Bahrain and Kuwait to the Persian Gulf, officials said. Amid the surge, supplies in hard-hit places such as New Delhi are running critically short. Health Minister Harsh Vardhan said India has enough liquid oxygen, but it's facing capacity constraints in moving it. Most oxygen is produced in the eastern parts of India, while the demand has risen in northern and western parts. K. Vijay Raghavan, a principal scientific advisor to the government, said this phase of the pandemic was a very critical time for the country. The United States, Britain, Germany, and several other nations are rushing therapeutics, rapid virus tests, and oxygen, along with materials needed to boost domestic production of COVID-19 vaccines to ease pressure on the fragile health infrastructure. India's vaccine production is expected to get a boost with the United States supporting a waiver of intellectual property protections for COVID-19 vaccines. Vaccine components from the United States that have arrived in India will enable the manufacturer of 20 million doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine, said Daniel B. Smith, the senior diplomat at the U.S. Embassy in New Delhi. Last month, Adhar Poonawalla, Chief Executive Officer of the Serum Institute of India, the world's biggest vaccine maker, appealed to President Joe Biden to lift the embargo on U.S. export of raw materials, which he said was affecting the production of COVID-19 shots. The government, meanwhile, described as totally misleading Indian media reports that it took 7 days to come up with a procedure for distributing urgent medical supplies that started arriving on April 25th. The statement said a streamlined and systematic mechanism for allocation of the supplies received by India has been put in place for effective distribution. The Indian Red Cross Society is involved in distributing supplies from abroad, it said. From the U.S., Department of Justice appeals federal judges' eviction moratorium ruling that could put 4 million at risk, by Khalida Rahman. The Biden administration is appealing a federal judge's ruling that strikes down the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's moratorium on evictions. The nationwide moratorium was imposed by the Trump administration last year to help Americans struggling to pay rent during the coronavirus pandemic. In March, the CDC announced an extension of the measure until June 30th. The moratorium was enacted under the Public Health Service Act of 1944, which gives the federal government the power to impose quarantines and other measures to combat public health emergencies. On Wednesday, Judge Dabney Friedrich of the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia, who was appointed by former President Donald Trump, ruled that the CDC had exceeded its authority when it extended the moratorium. It is the rule of the political branches and not the, it is the role of the political branches and not the courts to assess the merits of policy measures designed to combat the spread of disease, even during a global pandemic, she wrote. The question for the court is a narrow one. Does the Public Health Service Act grant the CDC the legal authority to impose a nationwide eviction moratorium? It does not. The Department of Justice has appealed the ruling, a spokesman has confirmed. The New York Times reported that Judge Friedrich has agreed to put her ruling on hold till May 12th to give landlords time to file legal papers opposing a longer delay. The eviction moratorium protects many renters who cannot make their monthly payments due to job loss or health care expenses, said Brian M. Boynton, Acting Assistant Attorney General for the Justice Department's Civil Division, in a statement announcing the appeal. Scientific evidence shows that evictions exacerbate the spread of COVID-19, which has already killed more than 500,000 Americans, and the harm to the public that would result from unchecked evictions cannot be undone. Supporters of the eviction moratorium have argued that it is necessary because the pandemic has not ended, and millions of Americans are still threatened with eviction or foreclosure. Almost 4 million people in the United States said they faced eviction or foreclosure in the next 2 months, according to the Census Bureau's Household Pulse Survey. Diane Yentl, president of the National Low Income Housing Coalition, has pointed out that there are now numerous conflicting rulings on the moratorium at the district court level. As a result, she told the Times, Friedrich's ruling could have a more limited application, impacting only the plaintiffs who brought the case or at most renters in the district court's jurisdiction. The Alabama and Georgia Association of Realtors were among the plaintiffs who argued that the ban on evictions simply shifts the financial burden from tenants to landlords. Much of the rental assistance hasn't been dispersed to struggling tenants yet. Most of the rent relief program started in late March and early April, Eric Dunn, director of litigation for the National Housing Law Project, told the Associated Press. It feels like the pandemic, at least in the United States, is coming to an end, but it's not over yet, Dunn said. If we have a wave of mass evictions, it could really set us back. And that's all the time we have for today. This is Ed Reedy. Please join me next week for the reading of Newsweek magazine.
Roxanne Watson is on a mission.
Hello, how are you doing today?
She wants more people to register as organ, eye, and tissue donors.
Are you an organ donor?
Yes, I am.
Yay! Alrighty.
My goal is to sign up the most people in the United States.
What drives her? Roxanne's own life was saved through the gift of a heart transplant, made possible by an organ donor.
I decided that day that I was going to devote myself to the cause of organ donation and signing people up and honoring my donor by doing that.
Now she's back to health, and she's a powerful force helping to save lives every day through her work. Imagine what you can make possible by leaving behind the gift of life.
8 people can be helped with the major organs, and up to 50 people can be helped with a little bit of everything. And when you think about it that way, that you could help that many people, it's amazing, it really is.
Learn more and sign up as an organ, eye, and tissue donor. Go to organdonor.gov. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Health Resources and Services Administration.